count us in, maybe.
Ready?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the Iditarod, a podcast about the Iditarod from Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Josh Edge. And before we get going, a quick word from our sponsor.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of fueling the 49th state, is proud to support Iditarod coverage on Alaska Public Media.
In our first few episodes, we've taken in-depth looks at the Kuskokwim 300 and Yukon Quest sled dog races, and we've relived the drama from last year's Iditarod. Now, we're going to talk about this year's race, the 2017 Iditarod. And this is our last weekly episode. Starting Sunday, March 5th, we'll switch over to a daily podcast, and we'll bring you the latest updates from the trail every morning until the race is over, even if it kills us. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or Stitcher, whatever podcatcher app you use, and that'll ensure you get the new episodes delivered right to your phone as soon as they're done. Today, I'm joined in the studio by the two reporters who will be out on the trail reporting for us for this year's race. Sitting across from me is Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes.
Hello, Josh.
And in the chair next to Zach is Ben Matheson from KNOM in Nome.
Hey, guys.
So, you two are getting ready to head out on the trail this weekend. How's that packing coming along?
Ugh. Ben, have you started?
I have large amounts of low-sugar, high-protein snacks, plus some new military surplus gear, so I'm ready.
You, on social media, looked like you were bunny boot shopping this weekend.
It took several phone calls and several in-person visits, but I finally did find the exact white pair that I wanted.
Did it make your heart sing?
It made my heart soar.
And Josh, in answer to your question, I still need some critical gear, but boots, jacket, getting ready for that, what's projected to be some serious interior cold. Thought I was going to get a new ruff made, but I don't think there's time for that. So
that's too bad.
Yep, but I'm thawing some moose jerky, so yeah, high protein, low sugar.
All the protein.
Give it up for protein.
So we touched on this a little bit in an earlier episode when the Iditarod Trail Committee first announced the change to the race route, but mushers will be taking off from Fairbanks this year. Zach, what's that going to look like for teams as they make their way toward that Burled Arch in Nome?
Good question. In short answer, it'll be a lot closer to the 2015 race. Teams will leave from Fairbanks. They'll take the Chena to the Tanana and then meet up with the Yukon. And that way it looks a lot like the northern route in traditional years. Except they'll be taking a detour up to Hooslia, about 80, 85 miles, somewhere thereabouts, and then back down to Kayakuk. And from there, they'll hit Kaltag, and it resumes the same route as in a, you know, any year.
Now, the normal route takes teams up the historic Iditarod Trail, but this one is more along the lines of the Serum Run that dog teams made to Nome back in the 1920s, right?
Yeah, the mythology behind the Iditarod race really is connected to the 1925 Serum Run when there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome, and really the only way to get things there and avert a crisis was this extremely harrowing, heroic trip by dog sled that was made by, it was coordinated in Nome with some of the territorial leadership, and that left from Nenana, which is a checkpoint this year, and it was kind of the mail route. Mail would come in through Seward, it would be taken by railroad up to Nenana, and then brought by dog sled to Nome. And amid just a exceptionally cold winter that year, 1925, they were able to do it in just a couple days, something like 678 miles, I want to say, from point to point. So not the 1,000-mile route that we're accustomed to, and certainly not over the Alaska Range, but this was 1925. We're coming up on the centennial of that Serum Run. And I think it's important to remember, too, that that was just a few years after the Spanish flu had just really decimated the population on the Seward Peninsula. So, you know, this potential for an epidemic really loomed large. And that was in large part why they were able to motivate such a heroic venture.
And along that trail, like the Iditarod route, there are historic roadhouses that served travelers, that served commercial traffic. And it's a set of trail that has modern use from village to village, as well as historic use that goes back before the Serum Run.
It's quite the history lesson.
Ben and I boned up on our Wikipedia earlier today.
Well, thanks. So obviously the route changes things for mushers, but it's also affected some of our own planning. How has this changed things for you two as you're getting ready to head out?
We were midway through planning and logistics. We were kind of starting to book stuff when we heard that the trail might change. A pilot in the interior kind of said, are you sure you want to book with us? This was in early February. It might get changed up, so you might want to double check. And we did. And sure enough, the plan ultimately changed. So we had to scrap a couple of things and just readjust. Obviously, leaving from Fairbanks for us means some different logistics up top, a few less nights at home in our own beds. But actually, the logistics on the northern route are a little bit easier. So we'll be spending a lot more time in Galena than we would have, a little bit more time in some of those smaller communities. I know Ben's going to be in Huslia for a while. I'll be in Kaikuk. Those certainly wouldn't be stops if we were on the traditional route.
So aside from the obvious change in strategies for teams with different checkpoints, they're going to be on a chillier route, winding along rivers in the interior. And there are two big rule changes as well that look like they have the potential to make a really big difference for mushers in the race. Two-way communications devices are now allowed on the trail, and mushers are no longer allowed to let dogs ride in the trailers towed behind their sleds. Ben, let's start with you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the trailer change?
The new rule is rule number 46, and it basically states that dogs have to be hauled in the front of the sled. They can't be hauled behind in trailers like they have been done for several mushers the last few years. Trailers can be used, but the rules also state that the mandatory equipment has to be in the front of the sled. So the rules really do amount to really cutting down the ability to mushers to haul dogs in the sled like this. This was a rule that had a lot of pushback from mushers. It was a controversial rule change. Mushers really liked having the flexibility to change up the rotation of their dogs to add some extra rest to certain dogs as they needed them. Mushers liked the ability to slow down their team if necessary. They can do things like redistribute the weight and ultimately just serve their dog team, they think, with the most flexibility. The rule change came about because of a safety reason, because of there are places on the trail where trailers can tip, where trailers could have some sort of accident. And it's one thing that we'll be watching as it's really turned into one of those tools that not every musher uses, but it's a Jeff King innovation that was adopted by the CVs, and it's something that a lot of top teams have really started to implement into their race plan.
When you were on at the Kuskokwim 300 this year, did you see people hauling dogs in trailers, or were people already beginning to experiment with, you know, what else they could haul to redistribute weight?
I did see at the start that dogs were in trailers, but it's one of my big open questions as to what ability mushers have to haul dogs in the bag and how that fits into overall strategies.
Moving on to the two-way communications rule, what's going on with that, Zach?
I think similar to the trailers, that's going to be an open question as to how people interpret that in their own strategies. What the rule says is that mushers can carry two-way communication devices now, and that includes cell phones, that includes satellite phones, so devices that for the first time you'd be able to use to communicate from the middle of the trail. Some people are concerned that this is going to lead mushers to, you know, be getting information and redesigning their strategies based on what their competitors are doing and stay in communication. There's also been sort of criticism that the solitude was a really big variable for mushers, especially in those later stretches when you're sleep deprived and you hit what some people call the white wall on the Yukon and it's just flat and blank and your mind starts to eat itself. And, you know, mushers have said, if I could call my family from when I'm going through that, you know, it would make a huge difference in my mental strength. But the Iditarod, through its board members, has said, look, this is a changing race. Lots of stuff has changed over the years, and this is just a reality now. Two-way communication is an expectation for most people, and it's not going to really change who's the toughest and who's working the hardest and whose dogs look the best and whose strategy is out there. A little while ago when I talked to Jeff King about this, he said that he doesn't plan on using one or even bringing one. However, if he sees other mushers who are getting a competitive advantage from the use of two-way communication devices, he may reconsider that in future races. It's also a little bit of an open question about how much it could actually help and where these devices will actually be able to sync up in all practical terms. I mean, your iPhone's not going to work from the stretch of trail going from Huslia to Kaikuk.
Do we know, Zach, how race officials may interpret this rule in context of Rule 31 that forbids outside assistance?
I have talked to people about this, and I'll be honest, I don't feel like I understand it 100%. You can't accept any physical assistance from outside competitors. So nobody can, you know, come over and help unbooty your dog. Like, that's always been true. Nobody can, you know, help you if your team is stuck, just drag you to a checkpoint. That stuff is still there. So it seems like what's really changed is the definition of outside help. And I don't think that communication, I don't think that passing along information is going to be considered there. I'm going to be really curious in the days ahead when we get some opportunities to talk to a lot of the mushers at some of the bigger gatherings, the banquet, the ceremonial start, about how they're interpreting this and how they're planning it. Because I'm much more curious in what they're thinking and what they know compared to some of the stuff that we're getting from the organizers.
Yeah, definitely some things to keep an eye on here as the race starts and moves toward Nome. So at this point, mushers have some miles under their belts, maybe a race or two as well. Based on what we've seen so far, who's looking good coming into this year's race?
We only get a few chances to see some of the top guys and top performers before the Iditarod. You'll get to see Jeff King and Pete Kaiser in the Kuskokwim 300. You'll see some road system mushers in the Kinnick 200, the Willow 300, Copper Basin, as well as the Yukon Quest. But quite a few of these guys don't do much before the race.
That's true. And then there's also, it's a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison to say, you know, who did well in a mid-distance race as a predictor of who's going to do well in a long-distance race. There's some indications, but it's certainly not one for one. And Ben, I think you were telling me that Mitch Seavey has pointed this out in the past.
Mitch Seavey ran the Tustamina 200 this year, and at the finish line, he said of his dogs, they just flew. But I was trying to keep them slowed down because we were trying to keep some semblance of law and order. I've trained a speed limit into them, and we completely blew that out of the water yesterday and today. So the strategy you take on a 200-mile race is completely different from what you're trying to sustain over 1,000 miles, and especially with a very disciplined racer like Mitch Seavey and Dallas Seavey, who are absolutely militant with keeping that speed and maintaining that speed to the coast. Comparisons are tough.
That said, I think there are some indications of who's looking really good this year, at least in the mid-distance races, and who's performed well in the past. So for me, you know, one person I'll be definitely keeping an eye on is Nicolas Petit. He won the Willow 300, performed really well in the last couple of years in Iditarod. He's been at the top of the pack. That said, he also has a little bit of a record of pushing his dogs just to the limit and sometimes tilting them over. So I think it was the 2014 Iditarod. He was one of the lead contenders and his dogs quit on him in Unalakleet. They were just tired. That happened again this year in another mid-distance race, the Copper Basin 300, where he was right at the front and then kind of dropped off. I'll be watching him. Obviously, Pete Kaiser, who won the Kuskokwim 300, has been at the top of the leaderboard in Iditarod the last few years. His third Kuskokwim 300 run tells me that that's not going to change. Wade Mars did really well last year in the Iditarod. He's kept up running a really competitive team in some of the mid-distance races. Zirkel, obviously one of the top contenders every single year. She's coming in with really strong dogs. Frankly, there's a lot of people to watch, and we haven't even gotten any indications on some of the biggest contenders like Dallas Seavey. So there's a lot of people out there from last year that I think you can expect to perform at a similar level.
This year, we have the top 10 returning from the 2016 race. Of the top 20, at my count, there is 17 of them who are coming back for this year. So as per usual, we have as competitive of a bunch as we ever do.
We'll be chasing them all.
And this route change means we're going to be seeing some pretty novel strategies as far as run plans and rest go. Ben, do you have any insight on what worked in 2015 and if that might be a template for this year?
Dallas Seavey, in his 2015 winning run, pushed all the way to Huslia before taking his 24-hour break. Aaron Burmeister also pushed that far. With the new familiarity with several of these mushers having completed the 2015 run, I'm looking to see who is interested in pushing all the way up to Huslia before taking that 24. One extra dimension of strategy that comes into play, one extra level of mathematic confusion perhaps, is that mushers can take their 8-hour rest on the Yukon before their 24-hour rest if they so choose. So for the first at least half of the race, you'll have people who have taken their 8-hour break and people who have taken their 24-hour break but not their 8-hour. And there's going to be a lot of conflicting timelines before you really know who's actually racing at the front in time. A couple strategies that we did see in 2015 for that 8-hour rest, 44 of the mushers took their 8-hour break in Tanana. Another 12 mushers pushed across one of the biggest stretch, 119 miles to Ruby to take their 8-hour, including Dallas Seavey and Yor Olsom. Others for the 8-hour waited a long time. Ali Zirkel pushed all the way to New Lotto. Aaron Burmeister waited until the last possible step to take his 8-hour, and that was in Kaltag.
Great. And before we see how all of this plays out. We do have the ceremonial start taking place as normal this Saturday in Anchorage. What can race fans and Ferrandiers in Anchorage expect to see on the streets of downtown?
Is that really the plural noun is Ferrandiers?
That's what I'm going with.
What can they expect? On Saturday morning, teams will be lined up in Anchorage for the ceremonial start. I think it's kind of confusing, especially if you're not familiar with Iditarod, that there's these two starts. Ceremonial start in Anchorage is really kind of a parade. A lot of the mushers are out there. Eventually, they start taking off from the starting line on one of Anchorage's main avenues in kind of short increments. And this is really a chance for fans to see people, for the sponsors to get right out in front. And it's, yeah, like I said, it's a big parade. The restart in Fairbanks, that'll be on Monday. And that's the actual start of the race. And that'll be a little different, both in terms of logistics and in terms of style. The open question right now is whether the ice on the Chena River is strong enough to support a large crowd and so many people. But there are temperatures down at, I think, around 30 below during the nights the next couple days. So they're waiting to see if that cold snap freezes things up enough to make it safe and secure. And we'll find out a little bit later this week.
Before we go, there is something new we're hoping to try. We want to get questions from you, our listeners, about what you're curious about when it comes to the trail. If you have any questions, we'd really like for you to send them to us. You can email them to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. But better yet, record yourself on a smartphone and email us. You can use a voice recorder or memo app. Almost all phones have these. Introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, and ask away. We actually reached out to some colleagues for questions this week, and we actually got quite a few responses from our friends out in Alaska Radio Land.
Hi, this is Rachel Waltholtz with Alaska's Energy Desk, and I remember the first time I saw an Iditarod dog team, I was surprised by how small the dogs are, and I'm wondering, why are the dogs so small, and is there a reason they use specific breeds for the Iditarod? Thanks. Looking forward to your answer.
Great question. Familiar question. And rather than belabor the point here, we actually did a video on the science and genetics of sled dogs that was made by Eric Keto and some of the other members of the video team and narrated by yours truly. And let's just play that.
Three, two, one, go!
What sets a sled dog apart from your everyday household dog? It all comes down to the basic innate motivation to run.
Say your sled dog would be in the NFL a wide receiver. You know, they're fast, they're light on their feet. A lab would be more like a defensive tackle.
Generally speaking, most dogs you find on the Iditarod are Alaskan Huskies. They're bred specifically for performance rather than physical attributes. So to the untrained eye, these dogs might not look like much, but to a musher, they're super athletes. So what exactly is in those genes that makes them so fast?
They have what we call hybrid vigor, and they've been crossed with various other breeds to try to give them more endurance, more speed. A lot of hound crosses in there, setter types, to give them more speed and stamina.
Although it's rare, purebred teams aren't unheard of. Elizabeth Norris and her family have the oldest Siberian Husky kennel in the world. Siberians are known for their pulling abilities and dependability, but have a bad rap for being big and slow.
I get asked a lot by people like, well, if you ever wanted to be competitive, would you switch to Alaskans? And no, like I really, in like I love the breed, like I adore these dogs.
Still, most mushers stick with a tried and true Alaskan Husky.
I'm very selective to what I'll breed into our breeding program, looking for certain traits with the dogs. They've got a lot of drive, they've got good solid heads, they're mentally strong, they've got a good appetite, they digest their food well, and they have a quick recovery time. Solid feet and good coats, and that's kind of what I focused our breeding program on. And managing that breeding program to a dog that I feel is one of the best dogs in the world for racing right now.
So there you have it, the ins and the outs of breeding a kennel of champions.
We'll put that video up on Alaska Public Media's Facebook page if anyone wants to see the full version. And on to the next question.
Hi, this is Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. And my question for the mushers is, how do they not die after a race? I've covered the Kuskokwim 300 twice, and after each time, I got very sick. I was out for days, and I think that if I was running the race, I would have died or just keeled over from exhaustion. So how do they not do that? How do they keep running all these races and keep living? Thanks.
The short answer is everyone gets sick, or a lot of people get sick. Last year, when I was on the trail, I got sick really quickly. As early as McGrath, I saw, you know, mushers like Wade Mars and Yor Leafs of Olsum also sick. A lot of people get sick. People are sleep deprived. And that's part of the challenge of the race itself, is just an endurance race and not sleeping. People do their best to eat at the checkpoints and get a little bit of rest. But I mean, it's exhausting. And as for what people do when they get to Nome to just keep from collapsing into a pile of just flesh and excess cold weather equipment, I don't really know. I'm sure everybody's got a different routine, but it's definitely a little bit of a recovery period, I think.
And we have one more question. Like a lot of sled dog trivia, this one is about poop.
I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. When I take a bunch of dogs out for a walk, I spend a lot of time cleaning up after them. And I've always wondered, how does the Iditarod deal with all that dog poop?
One piece that I would have added to the ceremonial start is that you've got strong smells of hot dogs and dog poop that accompany the hundreds and hundreds of sled dogs that are at the race. Basically, dogs poop extensively on their 10,000-calorie-a-day diets along the trail as they run. In checkpoints, volunteers will help clean up with straw, but on the trail, you get dog droppings.
These dogs are specially designed to eat a lot of calories and poop a lot of them out. So it's just in their nature. And anyone who's been mushing knows, you know, a lot of mushing is just dogs pooping.
One of my questions for mushers coming up is, how do you analyze your dog's stool? What do you look for in quality and content and characteristics?
I guess that's one more thing to look forward to. So that's all the questions we have for today. Please send us any of your questions you have about the Iditarod. We'll use a few listener questions throughout the race. Again, email those voice memos to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And that is all the time we have for today. Next time you hear from us, mushers and reporters will be heading up to Fairbanks for the official start of the 2017 Iditarod. Thanks to Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes and KNOM's Ben Matheson for joining me today. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Remember, starting this coming Sunday, March 5th, we'll be starting our daily episodes. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or listen on alaskapublic.org. That way you can listen every day until the race is done. I'm Josh Edge. Goodbye.
Basically, dogs poop extensively on their 10,000-calorie-a-day diets along the trail as they run. In checkpoints, volunteers will help clean up with straw, but on the trail, you get dog droppings.